looking live at the city of Moscow. Thousands and thousands of people are on the street around the Kremlin, as they usually are. Interestingly enough, you can see families and children, and they're all waving at me, and I'm waving back at them, because all of these people are filled with anticipation on this day, because, well, the president of Russia, their president, will be coming back soon to deliver his address to them on his take after meeting with the president of the United States, a historic meeting, a very important summit, which is the reason we are here. This is a special edition of the Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. All right, so let's do this. This is an important day. I'm Rick Sanchez. Happy to be here with you on this very special day. We made a decision here that we would do a show on a Saturday because there's really a lot to mull over, a lot to chew on, right? I mean, here you have, for the first time in a long time, and that's why this is so important, the president of the United States of America and the president of Russia, two nuclear superpowers. Let me just say that again, because apparently in the West, maybe they don't understand this. I've been watching many of my friends and colleagues over at CNN and Fox and all the other channels in the United States, and they're taking the description of this in just the opposite direction. Two nuclear superpowers are sitting down to have a conversation they haven't had in a long time, which, if nothing else, in and of itself is a win and could lead to perhaps a more peaceful world and can lead to perhaps an opportunity for a World War III to be avoided. And yet, what is the reaction that we're getting from most of the journalists and most of the politicians in most of the Western countries? Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to share some of that with you, but let me take you back to the summit, because I happen to think anytime these two leaders sit next to each other and hold a joint news conference, no less, where they both get to share their ideas after meeting and shaking hands and after having Mr. Putin fly all the way to Alaska, I think that's important. I think we should listen to them before we start telling everybody what we think of Putin or what we think of Trump. So here, first, is Mr. Putin's comment at this joint press conference.
We see a desire of the U.S. administration and President Trump personally to facilitate the resolution of the Ukrainian conflict, their desire to understand its essence. We have always considered the Ukrainian people our brothers, and everything that is happening is a tragedy and pain for us. Therefore, our country is sincerely interested in putting an end to this. But at the same time, we are convinced that in order for the Ukrainian settlement to be sustainable and long-term, all the root causes of the crisis must be eliminated. All of Russia's legitimate concerns must be taken into account, and a fair balance must be restored in terms of security in Europe and in the world as a whole. I agree with President Trump that the security of Ukraine must certainly be ensured. Of course, we are ready to work on this. I would like to hope that the understanding we have reached will allow us to get closer to that goal and open the way to peace in Ukraine. We hope that Kiev and the European capitals will perceive all this in a constructive manner and will not create any obstacles.
So all Mr. Putin is really saying is the same points that he's been making for the last 3 years. We are looking for security. We want to have a neighbor next to us, which, by the way, Russia and Ukraine have a history that goes back thousands of years, and we just want to make sure that Ukraine is neutral. They don't need to be pro-Russia. They just can't be anti-Russia, and they can't be run or ruled by other countries or third-party countries, right? That's number one. That's number one condition Mr. Putin has put on the table, and that has never changed. It's the same condition he put there 3 years ago. It's the same condition for which actually Russia went into Ukraine in the first place. Second condition that Mr. Putin is establishing at this point and has expressed to Mr. Trump is very simple. He wants to make sure that Ukraine's military respects the territory of Russians from now on, particularly Russia itself, and secondarily, the four oblasts, which are Russian-speaking people who are in Ukraine, which the Russian military, Russian soil, has essentially now captured. Essentially, this war is like over, according to all military analysts. And he's saying, let's just draw that line, and tomorrow we can sign a deal and we'll be done with it. So that's basically Mr. Putin's position. It's not that unreasonable to most people who have understood this conflict, right? So let me share with you now what the Europeans are saying, how they've reacted when they heard Mr. Putin and when they saw Mr. Trump and when they saw that they were shaking hands and smiling, and that it appears that there's the beginning of a relationship between, or the fostering of a relationship between Russia and the United States to make the world safer once again. What do you think the Europeans did? Do you think Starmer and Merz and Macron and the leaders of the EU were saying, you know, this is good, it's a good start? No, no. Let me read you the statement. I have it right here in front of me. It could not be more negative and more insulting. First line, here we go. Gene, have you got that up? It says, we are clear that Ukraine must have ironclad security guarantees to effectively defend its sovereignty and territorial integrity. So with the first sentence, they're already saying Ukraine should have the right to continue fighting. It should have the right to have its military stay where it is. It should have give up absolutely no territory, even though it's, you know, lost so much of its territory already. I mean, let me continue. They go on to say, we welcome President Trump's statement that the U.S. is prepared to give security guarantees. The coalition of the willing, what does that even mean? The coalition of the willing is ready to play an active role. No limitations should be placed on Ukraine's armed forces. I mean, with all due respect to Ukraine's armed forces, which these are some of the bravest military people I've ever seen. Ukraine's armed forces, these guys are tough. These guys have fought a good fight. They've defended their side well, by the way. So it's not to be critical of their armed forces. But unfortunately, they're losing or have lost. I mean, that's just a fact. It's not me saying that. It's every military analyst in the world saying that at this point. So they go on to say no limitation should be placed on Ukraine's armed forces or its cooperation with third countries. Do you hear that? Third countries. That means we the British, we the French, we the Germans have a right to continue running, ruling, and making decisions for Ukraine. We have a right to put our military hardware in Ukraine. We will continue to have a right to tell the to run the politics of Ukraine. Remember, these are the people who essentially removed a democratically elected president in Ukraine because they didn't like the fact that he was having friendly conversations with the Russians from time to time. Their prerequisite is, no, you're not allowed to talk to the Russians. You must hate the Russians. You must love us and hate the Russians. That's the only way this will work. And that's what they're saying here. That's essentially what this statement is saying, as crazy as that sounds. And then they conclude with the following. Russia cannot have a veto against Ukraine's pathway to join the EU or join NATO. I mean, let me read that again. Russia cannot have a veto against Ukraine's pathway to EU or NATO. They're basically saying, no, Russia, go to hell. You are not allowed to keep NATO out of Ukraine or the EU out of Ukraine. We own Ukraine, not you. I mean, it couldn't be more clear. They're saying this. They're actually saying the very thing which was the root cause, the provocation of the war. I find this crazy. I mean, I really do. I mean, maybe call me naive. I expected they would see the two leaders, the two most important countries in the world, which, by the way, UK, Germany, France, not important countries anymore. Sorry. Take a back seat. Yeah, your place is right back there behind India and behind China and behind a lot of other countries these days. Sorry, you lost. You're little. You used to be big, now you're little. But they want to be big. And they're literally saying, we have a right to take over Ukraine with this statement. Which, I mean, pardon me, I mean, I'm a little passionate about this. But I would have expected they would have at least been, they would have chosen their words more elegantly. And they would have said, look, maybe we could sit down and figure this out. But no, they're using a bludgeoning tool. They're saying, this is the way it's going to be. To hell with you, Russia. To hell with you, Donald Trump. No, we own Ukraine, and we want them to keep fighting. So they're going to keep fighting. And that's just the way it's going to be. Can you imagine the intestinal fortitude to come out and say something like that? We've got so much to talk about because it's not just their reaction. I also have some clips I'm going to be sharing with you of the reaction from my colleagues in the United States. But before we do that, I want to introduce you to our buddy anchor, as we call him here, where when we do the shows here from the Kremlin. It's a pleasure to introduce Christopher Hilali. He is an investigative journalist. He's a political analyst. He's a researcher. He knows this part of the world. He knows this story only too well. And he might think I'm full of crap. I might think he's full of crap when we have this conversation. But maybe that'll be good, too. So let's get started. Christopher, good to see you.
It's a pleasure to be here with you.
I am so glad that you're here. You look so handsome.
You too.
I hate when they have people as my guests who are more handsome than me. But so what do you make of that? I guess we start with that reaction from the Europeans. I was flabbergasted reading that. I mean, have they learned nothing?
They have not learned anything, and they're delusional. They're living in a fantasy land. They think that they still have cards at the table, and they don't. And I think that it's the political elite that feel this way. Their populations understand that not only have they suffered economically because of 4 years of sanctions, blockade, no gas, no oil, no tourism, no nothing, but on top of that—
You mean the Russians?
They've suffered because the Russians no longer have a connection with them.
Yes,
right?
Yes,
and,
yes.
And it's been really bad. I mean, I also have European citizenship. I can see what's going on in Europe, right? And it's been a real blow to their working class because they've lost a lot of economic opportunity and resources.
So wait, you're saying this position that I just read, that they just put out, we're going to continue to own it, they belong to us, the hell with Russia, the hell with Trump, this position they're taking is contrary to the needs of their citizens. That's what you're saying?
Absolutely, 100%. And that's been very much apparent in all of the streets around European capitals, where people have been openly protesting and saying, this is not sustainable. We already have issues with immigration. We have issues with our social welfare systems. We are being burdened by all of the hardship that we're facing as countries within Europe. And the European Union itself is screwing over many of the periphery countries, Greece, Italy, Portugal, Spain, Ireland. And now they want to send billions of euros more to Ukraine. People are saying, no, stop, it's too much.
But they don't care what the people say.
They don't. They don't.
This is insane. I've never, you know, I mean, talk about autocracy, right? Talk about autocracy. I mean, this is an autocratic government that tells its people, you have no right to think that you even have a right to tell us what you need or what you want. We decide what you need or what you want. I saw a Starmer interview recently where he was asked by, in fact, the BBC, well, if you continue the situation in Ukraine, and now if you also go into Iran, because apparently there's about to be another conflagration there. And if you continue helping Israel, Mr. Starmer, you know, once again, the people of our country here in the UK are going to suffer because their wages have never been lower and inflation has never been higher. And you know what Starmer said to that reporter? He said, well, the British people are tough. They understand they have to make sacrifices. And if they have to make more sacrifices, that's just what will have to happen. So he's like speaking for, you're a Brit?
No, I'm a Greek.
But you have a British citizen.
No.
Oh, no. I thought you said you had some kind of, but you have a Greek citizenship.
Yep.
So you understand the European mindset.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So
for
when he says that, what do you think the average European thinks when he hears that kind of comment?
This isn't Nazi Germany on our doorstep. We're not being bombed, and it's not London in 1940.
But look how dangerous those people look. Look at them.
It's
I mean, they look like any moment now they're gonna grab a Kalashnikov and. Right?
These are normal people. This is a society, like, really, the propaganda we're being fed is not only are they starving, they're warmongers on top of it.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
I don't know, it's like Schrodinger's cat. I don't know where we are. Like, one minute they are starving, there's no food, there's no food on the shelves, people are suffering under sanctions. The next minute, their military is coming and, you know, they're gonna invade the Baltics, they're gonna invade Poland, they're gonna take this and that. It's absolute hysteria from them.
And where does that come from? It comes from a mindset, right? A neoconish, pro-military, weapons manufacturing concept, which is, as long as we can keep wars going, it won't help the people, but who cares, because we're getting rich.
Absolutely, 100%. Think about the 10 years that over there, Boris Yeltsin was president of the Russian Federation. He was a best friend with Clinton. He had a very good relationship with the American administrations. But what did they do under his nose when they promised not to? They continued to expand NATO after they gutted this whole country.
Oh, yeah.
A period of catastroika, really. They sold everything off. They took everything. People were immiserated here. So the Harvard boys and the Chicago boys came here and absolutely liquidated the whole country. And that wasn't enough for them. They wanted more. Because where were they taught? They were taught in schools with people like Brzezinski, who said, Russia's too big, Russia's too powerful. We need to carve it up. It has too many different ethnic groups. Maybe we should turn it into Yugoslavia again.
Yeah.
And that has always been their dream. Their dream is Russia's too big, too powerful. It is the foremost nuclear power, not the United States. Russia's the foremost nuclear power. And they wanted it divided because it's easier to divide and to conquer
than it is to have an equal player. So your point is, really, for them, it's all about weakening Russia.
Absolutely.
So they can have dominion, so they can have superiority. And if in the process there are some wars that have to be fought as a result of weakening Russia, all the better, because every time a fighter jet goes down, we get to build another fighter jet. Cha-ching, we make more money.
Absolutely.
Those people are still, I believe, in Trump's ear. And I'm going to play a video for you now that made me think that as I was watching Mr. Trump's response to Mr. Putin. Gene, this is cut three. Go.
Mr. President, I'd like to thank you very much. And we'll speak to you very soon and probably see you again very soon. Thank you very much, Vladimir.
Next time in Moscow.
Oh, that's an interesting one. I don't know. I'll get a little heat on that one, but I could see it possibly happening.
Did you catch that? So Putin turns to Trump and says, okay, I came and met with you here. Next time we'll meet in Moscow. Perfectly normal. I'm in Moscow. You're in Moscow.
Here we are.
My friend Ritter was in Moscow. Napolitano was in Moscow. There's a lot of new, journalists who come here. And Witkoff was here just the other day, et cetera. And yet the first reaction from the president of the United States is, ooh, I'll get a lot of heat if I do that. Who's he thinking of when he utters those words?
Lindsey Graham, Blumenthal, this crew in Congress that he has to contend with. And don't forget,
And in the Pentagon. And in the war machine. Who's still
in his orbit? You still have, Bolton's a crazy one out there, but Pompeo was in Ukraine not too long ago, right? All these guys that were in his first administration are still within that circuit. They still have the lay of the land. They're still involved.
And they're still giving him, according to my sources, really bad information.
For sure they are.
They get in his ear as soon as the other guys leave the room and they go, Mr. President, let me show you. Look at this. See that? This is what the Russians did last night. And they make up some whatever. The Russians are bad people. You know why? Because Putin did this and the Russians, look at this report. And who the hell knows if they're just making some stuff up? And he doesn't know. So he goes out there and goes, I guess I have to hate the Russians too. Or, it just seems like he's fed this information. He's made to see not the real story, but the made up story. And when he said that, when I heard him make that comment last night, I'll get a lot of heat if I do that. Instead of saying, thank you, Mr. President, let's continue this conversation until we get to the place where we can create a better and safer world. No, his first response is, I get a lot of heat from that.
Absolutely. And not only that, think about, they're not only giving him the statistics of maybe, inflated or BS, Russia's attacking civilian centers, they're bombing hospitals, they're bombing schools, all of which is fake. They're also talking about, remember your shareholders. Remember who funded you, right? Because you gotta think about it.
Exactly.
Everybody in Congress, in the political elite, in the national security state, they are invested.
Yes.
Their pensions, their retirement, their 401k, you name it, they are funded by these major lobbies. Think of the big corporations, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, you name it, they're in there. This is trillions of dollars. Trillions, Rick. You know that as well as I do.
And it hurts to say this, but they also funded Trump.
For sure they did.
They funded his campaign.
For sure.
Who do you think made him president?
Come on, you can't get funding by just normal, average, working class Americans.
He was made president by those people you just named.
Absolutely.
And Israel.
Absolutely. And you know what? It's bipartisan.
Yeah. Oh, no,
in
I don't.
The United States, it's
bipartisan. I'm not saying Trump did something the other ones didn't do.
No, it's just a fact.
He did the same thing. Biden did the same thing.
Same thing.
Kamala, what's her name, did the same. Harris did the same thing. And everybody in Congress, save maybe two people, did the same thing.
That's
so,
right.
But that's unfortunate because what do the people of America have to do with that? What do they gain?
Nothing.
Nothing.
They lose.
Yes.
They lose. You know as well as I do. They lose. Our cities are crumbling. Our infrastructure is collapsing. It embarrasses me to see a subway and a metro system here, so-called third world, collapsing, no longer a superpower, with clean streets, with clean rail, with nobody doing all of this craziness that we see, people openly doing drugs on America's streets. And we're the ones that have the gall to say, we're going to impose our way on you.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to bring you democracy and human rights.
By the way, those things you just mentioned, do you see any of that here?
Nothing.
Do you see drug addiction here?
Nothing.
Do you see homelessness
Nothing.
Here? Yeah.
Nothing.
Do you see crime here?
Nothing. Zero.
Yeah, but
zero.
But these are the bad people.
These are the enemy, according to these people. These are the enemy. These people, we're going to go out there, they're going to hug us, they're going to take photos with us, they're going to kiss us. Thank you so much.
You mentioned a while ago that this started a long time ago after the Russians were guaranteed that NATO would not expand not one inch more as long as the Russians and the Americans made a truce and became friendly and all that stuff. So that was the promise, that was the guarantee that was made to Russia. Turned out to be not true. But I want to read something to you now. This is another reaction from the Europeans. Now, the European Union. Aha. This is Kaya Kallas. She says, I think, Gene, if you could put that up. This is whatever you have is a GFX3. European security, she says. She's angry, okay? This is her reaction to Mr. Trump and Mr. Putin talking. She says, European security is not up for negotiation. The real root cause of the war is Russia's imperialist foreign policy, not an imaginary imbalance in the European security architecture. Now, I'm not here to make excuses for Russia, what it does or what it doesn't do. I'm a journalist. All I do is look at the facts. So let's look at the facts, okay? If her argument is that Russia has been imperialist in that, and by imperialist, I mean, I guess it's gobbling up countries, taking over countries, expansionism, those things, right? That's what makes a country an imperialist country, right? So I'm going to show you now something that seems to prove the complete opposite of what she just said. So I'm going to read to you now a list of countries that used to be friendly with Russia, originally part of the Warsaw Pact, which means they were part of an association that was in cooperation with the old Soviet Union. And since then, they were still somewhat friendly with Russia. Well, these countries have now been gobbled up, taken over, owned by NATO, and the conditions are they have to have NATO weaponry, NATO missiles pointed at Russia in some cases, and they must hate Russia. That's the condition, right? Now, here are the countries. Ready? These are the countries that are now have been taken over by NATO. Czechia, Hungary, Poland, Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, Slovenia, Albania, Croatia, Montenegro, North Macedonia. These are countries that have been gobbled up, taken over by an expansionist NATO. And now they want to take over Ukraine as well. So, as I read you those, and now I read you again the words of the EU, Russia is an imperialist foreign country with an imperialist foreign policy. What do you say?
Projection, pure projection. Because the facts as you revealed them, and not only that, let's remember, it was the West that fomented chaos in the Caucasus with Chechnya.
Yeah.
It was the West that fomented the 2008 war in Georgia. Let's not forget that before Ukraine, there was a crisis in Georgia, Abkhazia, South Ossetia, boom, they wanted to join the EU and NATO. Again, expansionist. Russia had no issues.
Yeah.
Russia said, just protect the populations here, give them their autonomy. And what ended up happening? No, we want to join in your soft underbelly. Only a few hours drive from Stalingrad, Volgograd today. We want to join this hostile military alliance. Then comes Ukraine. Now you have an expanding NATO further and further. And not only that, encirclement. We got to get to the Arctic.
Right.
We got to get to Central Asia.
Right.
We got to push from the Far East. You see all of these things? How, if I'm a Russian, if I'm sitting in there, just like if I'm in Washington, if I'm sitting in there, and you yourself, I believe, have roots in Latin America, if you think about the Cuban Missile Crisis, they were nervous. They said 90 miles off the coast, we're going to have, medium-range ballistic missiles with nuclear weapons. It's not tolerated. The Soviets understood that. They understood it was a provocation. They backed down. The Europeans and NATO are not backing down today.
Yeah.
They're not backing down.
No, they still want to move forward.
You know why?
Why?
Because Khrushchev and Kennedy fought and saw war firsthand. They were on the same side in the Great Patriotic War in World War II. Today, these people are career bureaucrats. They've never seen a war.
Oh, my God.
They send other kids to go fight.
Look at Macron. I mean, he's a boy toy. He's like some model.
Of course.
Some little kid who was chosen because, you look very handsome and very pretty, so we're going to make you president. When I hear him speak, I don't hear depth. I don't hear anything. Starmer, as I just mentioned. There's no Merz. I mean, who are these people? There doesn't seem to be any foundation for these people being here. It just surprises me that they are in the position they are. And, and really on the question of this NATO expansion, one can't help but wonder the gall, the unmitigated gall. They have taken over almost every country, forbidden them from being friends with Russia, and these are old friends of Russia, and then put missiles and military hardware in there, pointing it at Russia, and they expect Russia to just say, oh, that's okay. Oh, that's okay. I mean, the unmitigated gall, the hypocrisy of that condition seems just incredible that they would have that position. I don't understand how they can make those points and not know that people around the world are understanding that, but yet in the West, they don't.
They don't?
Yeah.
And I've talked to people and I've written about this even before the special military operation. When the United States had the Monroe Doctrine, they said, this is our sphere. Nobody gets involved.
Yeah.
Even recently, just a few years ago, Russia sent Tu-160s, right? These white swans to Venezuela. These are the equivalent to the B-1 bomber, right? Uh-huh. They sent them there. Two of them landed there. America had a fit. Wait a minute. Yeah. How are you bringing them to our hemisphere? And that's way down there in South America. But we want to put it right on the border, and nobody should complain.
Think about that.
Come on. It's the hypocrisy. It's the double standards.
The NATO and the U.S. were doing military exercises in the Black Sea.
In the Black Sea.
In full view of Russians who were on the beach with their families.
Absolutely.
Having a beautiful Saturday afternoon like right here today. And they're watching U.S. helicopters and U.K. Warships landing. And they're going, why are you doing this? Could you imagine if China was doing military exercises on Lake Superior?
Or off the coast of San Diego, where we have a massive naval installation, right?
Right. I mean,
the U.S. wouldn't tolerate it, actually.
No,
the U.S. would not. They would see it as an immense provocation.
Nor would the U.S. have tolerated China going to Canada, removing the president of Canada because he was too friendly with Washington and putting in somebody else who was antagonistic toward Washington, which is the exact same thing that happened in 2014 in Ukraine, and it's been proven over and over again.
Absolutely.
How can you deny that?
There's no denying it.
But here's somebody who doesn't know this, okay? Here's somebody who doesn't know this. One of the foremost journalists in the United States. His name is Jake Tapper. And here he is explaining to his audience in America what just happened between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. Take it, Gene.
President Trump called the meeting extremely productive. He definitely tried to put a positive spin on, let's be frank, he was trying to bring peace and end a war. I mean, there's nothing wrong about his goal, but it does appear that there really wasn't anything concrete achieved. No ceasefire, no sanctions relief or sanctions imposed. We don't really know where we are other than Putin got himself a summit in Alaska. What do you make of what we just saw?
Oh, Putin got himself some great time on... The only thing he cares about is the fact that Putin didn't look bad on camera, and that's not good. So to him, it's all about Putin being the bad guy. It's all about... See, when your mind is simple and you know nothing, all you know is everything is a soap opera. It's good guy, bad guy. Good guy, bad guy. This is not about good guy, bad guy. You know what this is about? This is about the peace of the world. This is about two countries that could possibly get together to avoid World War III. You know what this is about? It's about my granddaughter. It's about my granddaughter. It's about my children, your grandchildren. That's what this is about. It's not about whether a guy's a good guy or a bad guy. It's insane that this is the analysis this moron, this idiot, does after watching two leaders of two world superpowers have a summit.
Listen, you know as well as I do, we are the closest we have ever been on the doomsday clock.
Yeah.
The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists have put it out that we are very close to midnight, just a few dozen seconds away. And you know what that says to me? It says that any opportunity for the two largest nuclear superpowers to meet and to have diplomatic relations, whatever the outcome, is a good thing. Mm. It's a thing for your kids, my kids, everybody's kids. Mm-hmm. It's a way to bring us back from the brink.
Yeah.
It's a way to establish some security worldwide. And if they had these abnormal relations for 4 years, I was very happy to see them shake hands last night.
Right.
We might not solve all the problems.
Right.
It might not.
But it's a start.
It's a start.
Yes.
They're talking.
And it's okay. You can hate Putin. You can hate Trump. You can hate whoever you want to hate. And or you could like them. Or you can and you can criticize their policies. But just the fact that they're talking cannot be a bad thing.
No.
And it's being reported by these politicians in Europe and by the media in the United States like it's a bad thing. Here's another moron. This is probably the dumbest man in American media as far as I'm concerned. Here is Fareed Zakaria. He too appears angry that Putin was allowed to look good. Take the cut, Gene.
Yeah, I think you have it right, Jake. Look, the atmospherics of the entire summit were somewhat cringeworthy. The fact that Putin was being welcomed on American soil, the fact that Trump gave him literally a red carpet treatment, the kind he has rarely given to any, you know, democratic ally of the United States. You can tell that Trump thinks Putin is, you know, is an equal, is this big shot on the world stage, and he's been treated by the rest of the West as a kind of pariah. I mean, he can't go to Europe because he'd be arrested. And so there was a lot of the atmospherics that were cringeworthy.
Once again, I mean, you're listening to this guy who is... And let me tell you something, okay? I looked it up. Jake Tapper makes $8 million a year. Fewer people will watch his show than are watching us right now. By a mile. I mean, we get... You know, tens of millions of viewers. He's lucky if he can get 500,000 on a really good day. My podcast gets more people than Jake Tapper. So let's look at that business model. an anchor in America working for CNN makes $8 million a year on a show that gets this much of an audience compared to some of the podcasts of people like Tucker Carlson, Napolitano, even my own, many cases. How is that? I'll tell you how that is. So CNN doesn't have a big audience anymore. But you know what they do have? They have sponsors. And those sponsors' names are Raytheon and General Dynamics and other huge corporation that gives CNN millions of dollars for advertising. Now, what person watching CNN do you think needs to buy a bazooka or a jet plane to maybe, I don't know, fire off missiles or something like that? None. They're basically buying the words of Jake Tapper. So Jake Tapper and this other guy, Fareed Zakaria, they're purveyors of a message that their news channel wants them to purvey, to tell. And that news channel is being fed money by these people who are weapons makers. And that, I just painted the picture for you. So when somebody tells you the American media is a free press, no, it's not. Less of a free press, in fact, I would argue, than many of the other press around the world that they criticize.
I absolutely agree. And let's not forget, Jake and Fareed are the biggest cheerleaders for the war on terror, quote unquote, that we ever had on mainstream media. They were the ones advocating for interventionism, not only in Afghanistan and Iraq, but in Libya, in Syria. They wanted to confront Russia. They want to confront China. They see the DPRK as a threat.
Yeah.
They see the so-called troika of tyranny, Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba, as having to be confronted, even militarily. These are the people that are propagandists of the highest order. And you know what? They're, especially Fareed has written a couple books. They're being used in college classrooms.
Oh, he's the worst.
And he's the worst. And these are the ones who are like, oh, we have a duty to spread our democratic values, our liberal order.
We have to
impose it.
I'll never forget.
You know.
I was there the day they hired him. And John Klein, the president of CNN, Rick, get over here. I want you to meet Fareed. And he was being, you know, chauffeured around. And you know, he had all this these people around him. And you could just tell he was a stooge. He was a sellout.
That's
they were
it.
Getting themselves their guy to espouse their point of view, which you know is always going to be pro-war and pro-Israel,
yep.
Which is exactly what he's delivered.
Absolutely.
He's good for life. They'll keep giving him $5 million. Oh, yeah, by the way, so Fareed makes $5 million, according to the Googles, and Jake Tapper makes $8 million. Why? It's a lot of money to pay somebody who's a journalist.
They're the real marionettes.
He's not. Yes. Not exactly. I mean, and that's upsetting. In the end, I think, tell the truth. Because you know what the truth is? The truth is, anytime we have two world leaders having a discussion about something as important as avoiding nuclear war, Ukraine's important, but it's not as important as the relationship between Russia and the United States. And people need to understand that. You know, Ukraine is just a proxy that's being used to get at Russia. By the way, I have an announcement to make. I've just been told by my producers, if I'm understanding them correctly, that we're about to go to the Kremlin. Apparently, as I mentioned earlier, we are expecting that we're probably going to get some comments from the Kremlin regarding the meeting with Mr. Trump. And I think that's going to be happening now in just a couple of minutes. So they're going to count me down. And we'll go to the Kremlin as soon as they're ready. But you were going to say.
I was just going to say that, look, these two and many other American journalists never had the intestinal fortitude to travel to Donetsk, to Lugansk, to Crimea to see what was going on the ground.
Yeah.
They parroted propaganda saying that, oh, Russia's intervention and Russia fueled the whole thing and Russia invaded without talking to the people. I've been to the Donbass twice. I've spoken to the people. I've seen where the kids were killed, where the horrors and atrocities by Ukrainian armed forces were committed against the people of the Donbass. And you know what? Everyone said, even I was a proud Ukrainian, now I only believe in Russia. I only want Russia because Russia defends me.
You know, and it's funny, I hear a lot about how, you know, this war has been so deadly. In actuality, it's been deadly for the soldiers. And the Russian soldiers have fought bravely. So have the Ukrainian soldiers. The Ukrainian soldiers have also fought bravely for their cause. And they're soldiers. They have a duty, they're told what to do, and they go out there. But here's the interesting thing about this war. It has not been a civilian casualty war. The civilian casualty has been minimal compared to what's happened. According to the official record of names they can count, 62,000 people have died in Gaza. And according to Western sources, I can Google it for you right now, 13,500 people have died, civilians, in the war in Ukraine. And it's lasted almost three times as long as the war in Gaza. The war in Ukraine, the Americans, my country, apparently some 500,000 to 750,000 Ukrainians died, civilians, once again. So I do believe that the Russians, because those are their cousins, because they feel a brotherhood to the people of Ukraine, have been careful not to kill a lot of civilians, and they don't go into towns until most of the people have already abandoned the town.
Most Ukrainians came to Russia as refugees. Most people don't talk about that. Most came here. I have many friends who were born in Ukraine who now have Russian citizenship, and they said, we are thankful that Russia took us in.
Do you think, by the way, do you think, Christopher, all right, we're just told that we're ready to go. We take you now live to the building behind me. That's the Kremlin. Here now, the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin.
Colleagues, good afternoon. I convened this meeting to inform you about the outcomes of our delegation's visit to the United States, Alaska. I'd like to note that it was a very timely and a very useful visit. We covered most of the areas of our interaction, but the most important aspect, of course, was finding a resolution to the Ukrainian crisis on a fair basis. We had an opportunity to discuss the genesis and the root causes of that conflict, and it is an understanding of these root causes that must be the basis for a settlement. We did not hold any such talks on a high level for a long time. And I'm satisfied that we had an opportunity to lay out our position. We have also listened with interest to the American side. We're also interested in making this, bring this to an end. And we're willing to use all peaceful means to make that possible. It was a very substantive discussion, and I believe it brings us closer to a solution.
And there you have the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, making some comments. He's back here in the Kremlin. And some of our reporters will no doubt be getting more information as you know, the information flow from a story like this usually is not meteoric. It doesn't happen overnight. Unfortunately, to the consternation of the Jake Tappers and the other idiots in the American media who are disappointed that immediately after the meeting with Mr. Trump, the end of the war was not announced and an exact breakdown of when it would end and the names of all the soldiers who would walk away at any given time would be delivered as well. It's just incredible to think that they think, or they're so naive. But, you know, in many ways, and Christopher, let me bring you back into this. Let me tell you something else that maybe you need to understand about the American media. These people know nothing about geopolitics. Jake Tapper knows only about American politics. He knows who Nancy Pelosi is. He knows what she had for breakfast. He knows what Lindsey Graham is. He knows what Lindsey Graham's husband does. He knows everything about American politics. And if there's a controversy where some famous actor said something stupid or fell down, he'll know everything about that as well. But in terms of understanding the Indian economic system or the GDP of China or what's going on between Sunni and other relationships with countries that are Shiite, for example, like Saudi Arabia, when it comes to understanding what was the root cause of the Ukrainian conflict, when it comes to understanding China and how its economy grew, any of these things, he knows nothing, nothing. They're not expected to. So when he gets in front of a camera now to talk about this relationship between Mr. Putin and Mr. Trump, it would be like having me do the narration of a ballet. I know nothing about ballet, right? But I can say they look pretty and that's a gorgeous uniform and it looks like he or she went around in circles very nicely. But that's it. That's exactly what you get from the American media. They are ignorant, remain ignorant. They don't talk, they wouldn't, he has probably, this is probably the first time that Jake Tapper has ever had a Vladimir Putin speech as a part of his newscast. He's never seen Vladimir Putin except on Saturday Night Live without a shirt on. That's it. To him, Vladimir Putin is just somebody who they make fun of. So this is how far removed they are from that reality, which is why they're dumb enough to think that just because these two guys met and the war didn't end 10 seconds after they had their news conference, that everything is wrong and it didn't work and it was a bad summit. Am I wrong?
No, I think you're absolutely right. Listen, these people not only don't have a firm grasp of history and geopolitics, they are taught in their universities, some of the finest institutions, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, University of California, Los Angeles, you name it. They are taught only a slice and a version of that history and geopolitics, which serves the ruling class's interests, the oligarchs' interests, the big business and moneyed interests. That's what they're taught. Yeah. They're not taught to critically think. They're taught this is the way it is, and you parrot it, and you're going to do financially very well for yourself and your family.
Yeah, well, that's what happens, especially when you come. Well, I got to tell you something. I went to the University of Minnesota, the Eric Severide School of Journalism. I'm proud to have gotten a journalism degree where I learned that facts matter, that sources matter, that you need to dig deep, that you need to surround yourself with smart people and ask the right questions and try and share truths with people. So when I went to CNN and they automatically gave me $1 million in contract, which I didn't even think I deserved at the time, but I now realize why they give people like me $1 million, because they're essentially trying to buy me. And when I started trying to buck them and say, wait, why do I have to report this? And why can't I report this? And I started feeling like they were not liking the fact that I was doing that. And eventually they fired me. They just said, you're fired. We don't want you here. You're asking too many questions. You're doing too many things that we don't want you to do. And by the way, from now on, when you show up, we want you to read what's been written for you.
Correct.
Have you seen me reading here at RT anything?
No.
Have you seen anything? Here's my notes. Here's how we're doing the show. These are the notes I made before we started on the air today. That's it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's no conspiracy. There's more free speech in Russia than there is in the United States. Here,
100%.
Boom. Let me just 100%. Say it. Don't you feel that way?
Absolutely, I feel that way. I mean, we have been given unfettered access. They say, you want to go to Donbass? We'll take you. We'll take you right to the front line, even putting ourselves in jeopardy. They said, we want you to see it. We want you to report it because they're not showing you the truth over there. And that's really important.
You know, it's funny. I get that sense, too, when I'm around here. The other day, I told this to Scott as well. The other day, I went to this hotel across Four Seasons. Mm-hmm. We were done doing a show here, and I went, my wife was here, and I said, honey, let's go get a drink. So we went to the Four Seasons, and we had a drink. And the waitress and the bartender, we got into like everybody in Russia or anybody anywhere in the world, we got a conversation about politics. And the waitress and the bartender hated Putin and were criticizing him. We're talking about, he's messing up the war, and he's doing that and that. And my wife said, are they allowed to do that here? Yes, everybody's allowed to give their opinion. Some people like him, some people hate him, some people think this, some people think that. And everybody has an opinion about everything. I mean, to be fair, his favorability ratings are enviable. They're around 85% right now. So generally speaking, people are satisfied with the Putin government. But there's still people out there who, you know, are mad at something he did or something he didn't do, anybody anywhere else in the world, right?
Listen, it's a big country and there's a lot of different viewpoints. You know, a lot of people here have been educated. Also, some in the West, they have their own views. Some are more liberal, some are more conservative, some are more religious, some are not as religious. It has that diversity, and the beauty of Russia is that it embraces that diversity.
Yeah.
It self-identifies as a multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multilingual society, and it understands that it has a variety of viewpoints. And where else do you have a president who goes to Chechnya and kisses the Quran, who goes and meets with Jewish leaders, meets with, you know, animistic and Buddhist leaders in the Far East, and goes to church and is accepted by everyone and really shows care and concern and does not allow anyone to weaponize those things against the state like they do in Europe?
I thought that one of the most impressive things that Mr. Putin did, I don't know if he thought of this himself, or maybe some of his other guys like Lavrov said, you know, I got an idea, let's do this, was basing his speech on the fact that the United States and Russia are neighbors.
Absolutely.
I never even thought of that.
Absolutely.
When most Americans, and I'm sure you and most Europeans, think of Russia and the United States, they think of them as far away. Because when you think of it in the European normal map, that's how you see it.
Of course.
But when you turn the map, you realize the Bering Straits, you could practically throw a rock from China, from Russia to the United States. They are neighbors. And when he came out and said, you're my neighbor, Mr. Trump, let's be friends.
Absolutely.
Because we're neighbors, we should get along. I thought that was really, A, smart, and B, kind of classy.
Absolutely. That's how Russians feel about the United States. You know, we're taught in the U.S. that all Russians, like, have this innate hatred of the United States, and they're all commissars, and they're going to come, and it's going to be Red Dawn, right, and they're going to parachute in and take over the U.S. That's not at all what they feel. They feel a kinship. They feel, and let's not forget, the Russian Empire helped the United States as a nascent country,
yeah,
and helped the revolution. It helped in the war in 1812. It helped in the Civil War. It helped in World War II, back and forth. And you know what? It didn't escalate things, even though it could have, and it had its hardliners.
Right.
It didn't escalate things, and you know what? It gracefully fell in 1991 without the chaos that many in America expected. But who fomented the chaos from within? The United States,
yeah,
and certain individuals, because they need an enemy. Even as Russia tried to get closer, even as Russia said,
no,
let's be friends.
That's what you just described as an official policy that was written, I believe, in 1995 that became the official policy of the United States. Now that Russia's weak, let's make them weaker so we can have superiority both over Russia as well as China. And that's the goal of the United States, and it's been the goal ever since. And it seems foolhardy.
Absolutely.
There's nothing wrong with you being strong and somebody else being strong as well.
That's how politics has been throughout history. That was the balance of power in Europe. And you know what? This idea of a project for a new American century, that America has to be the hegemonic power, it has to be a unipolar world. That
and preemptive.
And you know what? That immiserates our population in the United States equally as much as the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And Russia's saying, look, we have our sphere traditionally, Ruskiy Mir. We have this world that has existed through millennia, but we also want to be friends with China, with the United States, with India, with the European Union, with Brazil, with South Africa. We want to have good relations, win-win.
I'm glad you mentioned the new American century, because it just so happens, and I think we have that. Gene, see if you can give me the next cut. This is a member of the new American century. These are the people who got together along with Wolfowitz and Kagan and many others.
Rumsfeld.
And they and the Bushes.
And the Bushes,
and they created a secret coalition. The goal of the secret coalition, you could look it up, is to essentially create a world where the United States dominated. But to do this, we had to, first of all, control and take over the Middle East at the behest of Israel. And this is the formation of the group who decided that we would make an excuse to invade Iraq, even though Iraq had done nothing to the United States, by telling the world and telling the American people that Iraq was actually responsible for 9/11. So these are the people who did that, and this is one of the guys who led that push. And here he is now talking last night about the meeting between Mr. Putin and Mr. Trump.
Trump did not lose, but Putin clearly won. Trump didn't come away with anything except more meetings. Putin has, I think, gone a long way to reestablishing the relationship, which I've always believed was his key goal. He has escaped sanctions. He's not facing a ceasefire. I thought Trump looked very tired up there. Mm-hmm. I mean, very tired. Not disappointed, tired. And we'll have to reflect on what that means.
He's mad that Putin looked good, and he's mad at Trump and thought he looked real tired. It's funny, if Trump had done nothing but criticize Putin and called him names, then Trump would not have looked tired. He would have looked courageous, of course, in the eyes of John Bolton, who is one of the members of the Project for the New American Century. Look it up, by the way, if you're bored tonight and you have nothing to do.
John Bolton has never seen a war he hasn't fallen in love with. And you know what? He hasn't gone and fought. He hasn't been on the front lines, and he hasn't sent his kids out there either. But you know what? They're happy to send other American boys and girls to go fight and die in these wars for the projection of American power while the United States is collapsing within.
Yeah.
But John Bolton, by the way, is the key architect for massive destabilization in Latin America. He wants to overthrow the Iranian government at the behest of some terrorist organizations, the Mujahideen Khalq, based in Albania. He wants to foment regime change in Russia.
Yes.
He wants to go after China. This man is ready for worldwide World War III. He's ready.
So I would never be interviewed on CNN. You would never be interviewed on CNN. Scott Ritter would never be interviewed on CNN. Professor Jeffrey Sachs would never be interviewed on CNN. But Bolton is on CNN every single night espousing this stuff.
I was invited to CNN just a few months ago because my friend was arrested, a Palestinian student, Mohsen Madawi. And you know what? Right before I was to go on air,
they canceled it. Of course they did.
They canceled
it. They looked you up.
They looked me up and they said, we can't put him on air.
This guy has told truths. We can't have somebody on the air who tells truths. It's amazing.
It is.
It's amazing. Well, listen, I think I just realized you and I have now been talking for almost an hour. That's what happens when you put a Cuban and a Greek together. last minute, tell me what you think the takeaway is and where this goes now. Are you encouraged by where we are right now?
Listen, I'm encouraged that they're both speaking. I don't think that we're going to have a resolution tomorrow. I think it's going to take time. The root causes, as President Putin has said, need to be addressed. But I think it's important that these two powers are speaking to each other, are at least having normal communication and dialogue. And that is important.
Do you think Mr. Trump's handlers, in other words, the people who really run the presidency of the United States, the real presidents of the United States, will let him come to Moscow?
Listen, I'm not so sure. I think that that's going to be something that they're not
going to... Isn't that a crazy question I just asked you?
I know, because you
think... Is the president of the United States allowed to be the president? That's what I just asked.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I don't think so. I think that there's a lot of pressure around him not to do that. And I'll tell you one thing. There are three things that I really thought were important that really weren't picked up on. Number one, there was a B-2 flyover. When they went up to the stage after they shook hands, there was a B-2 that flew over. And of course, we know just some weeks ago, after the 12-day war with Iran and Israel.
That was the neocons.
Right. They said,
we're here.
We're here and the B-2 can come to Moscow. So I thought that that was kind of like, you know, sort of like a one-upmanship. And also they canceled the secondary meetings and they didn't have the working lunch. So they at least talked. Maybe we're not seeing eye to eye on some issues.
I hope
so. But the important thing is we got to continue to talk. Dialogue is essential.
Props to President Trump for at least having this meeting. Instinctually, I think his heart is in the right place. I'm not sure if he'll be able to push back or fight off all the bad guys in the U.S. government who are telling him not to do this. So I hope he can win.
I hope so, too.
I'm pulling for President Trump.
Listen, I'm pulling for both of them.
Yes.
That they can come together as men, as leaders, and really push everybody else aside and say, look, for the betterment of the world, our children, our grandchildren. They're both parents. They're both grandparents. Let's build a better world. Let's do it together. That's what I hope.
Christopher, thank
you. Absolute pleasure.
You've been great.
Absolute pleasure.
It's been a great conversation.
Look forward to seeing you again.
I love the passion with which you speak, and you've got a loud voice, and you feel it. And,
absolutely.
You know, that's,
we're on the front line.
Yeah.
We're on the front line.
That's so great, man. Thank you so much.
I really appreciate you being here. Thank you so much.
And that's our special edition show of... Sanchez Effect. It's really been important, I think. And I got a little passionate, and I apologize if maybe I got a little too passionate trying to describe this. But to watch people lie right through their teeth like this about something which is so important. I mean, rather than talk about the opportunity for peace, they're nitpicking and talking about this guy's good and this guy's bad. It just seems so juvenile. Pardon me for being so judgmental in my description of it. Nonetheless, I'm Rick Sanchez. This is The Sanchez Effect. You can also find some of the cuts from this, by the way. You'll see it on Journalistically Speaking with my commentary as well, in case you didn't get enough. We'll be looking for you again. Good night.